Hey kids, welcome to another edition of Conspire a Theory. I have with me, coming back, Jack Connor. Say hello to the kids, Jack.
Hey.
So we have decided that it is time for us to come back and discuss more steampunk-esque type fun and enjoyment and movies and stuff. And right now, the big thing that's really got both of us going is Battle Angel Alita. And that's sort of a cyberpunk type of thing. It piques my interest, even though, you know, steampunk and cyberpunk are totally different. Steampunk is sort of bizarro cyberpunk. So
there's a crossover. I would argue there's a crossover.
Yeah, definitely. And with Battle Angel Alita, it sort of builds that sort of world that is just so appealing to whatever type of punk you're into. I mean, the world of Battle Angel Alita is, it looks old, it looks lived in, and yet it has elements of the future that we can only imagine. You know,
I would argue it's almost, you know, it's post-apocalyptic cyberpunk that is so post-apocalyptic that it has almost been reduced to steam level technology. So it's kind of like a fusion of steam and cyberpunk and post-apocalyptic.
It's not old-timey. It has a more modern feel to it, but it's still appealing and futuristic and grand. What I want to mostly talk about is in Battle Angel Alita, it was sort of this, this underappreciated, underrated film that came out that had this remarkable story and it did all these wonderful things that people claim they want to see in their modern cinema, but by not supporting this film and by not, you know, making it a blockbuster, even though it did well enough, it wasn't exactly blockbuster numbers in our American audiences. And most American audiences, they claim they want to see what we found in this film, which was a strong female character, a diverse cast, a good story, all these things that we hear, you know, why aren't we getting this? Why aren't we getting this? We need this. We need this in, and we're going to get it in Captain Marvel, which we're going to talk about later. And then I'm saying, well, have you seen Battle Angel Alita? This is getting everything you claim you want. And our pop culture zeitgeist is telling us that they want. And yet there was almost like very small sort of underdog support for this film. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that's being, well, on one part, I think it's being, I don't know if the word is morally or ethically dishonest.
Hypocritical.
Maybe. Yeah. It's being very hypocritical, but it's like we hear these claims, and it's usually from, you know, pop culture people on the left, you know, not to cast sides or anything, but they claim that they want this agenda, and this film meets their agenda, their proposed agenda, and it's entertaining and good, and it's everybody. I very rarely find people who don't like the film unless they're completely, it's just not their thing.
Yeah, no, it was a crowd-pleasing movie that everybody that I know really, really enjoyed, if not outright loved. It's giving the audiences what they want. It's giving the, you know, the political moment what it wants, you know, mm-hmm. racial representation, strong females, all that good stuff, and a quality package. It's just going to barely break even. I seriously doubt we're going to get a sequel. Unless maybe the Blu-ray sales are just astounding or something like that.
Well, the American market is not supporting the film. We have like hardcore fans like me and you who love this movie and we champion it. But the general audience is, you know, they're largely staying away from this. And I can kind of understand this. I kind of feel like a lot of this movie kind of went over their heads, and it kind of gave them a bit too much too soon.
And you know, maybe the trailers, the first trailers I saw really did not inspire me at all. I really, you know, I they had some weird song overlaying it, and then there was her googly eyes, and you know, why are they making Alita a tune? You know, I've been a fan of Alita Battle Angel, or Battle Angel Alita, as the manga is called, for a long time. I read it when it originally came out, I think in the 90s, and really enjoyed it. And, you know, shortly after I read it, James Cameron acquired the rights to it. And so I have been looking forward to this movie for a long time.
20 years.
And 20 years. And it really lived up to all my hopes. But I did see the trailers, and I saw her with her big googly eyes, and I said, what are they doing to Alita?
Yeah, that was my concern as well. And when I saw the movie afterwards, I was like, wait a minute. The googly, the big eyes were the least of my worries.
Absolutely. It worked for the movie.
Yeah, it really did. When you see the movie as a whole, they really don't matter, because she fits in with the rest of the world, because there's so much in the world that is exaggerated, and her as a character, you know, yeah, she fits in, and you see others like other, there are Martians. There are other Martians, which is where she's from, with the big eyes. And it's like, it's not weird.
Yeah, I mean, out of all the things to, you know, to pick at, you know, that is such a nitpick extreme.
Yeah, it's extremely superficial.
There weren't a whole lot of things to pick at in that movie. It was a really well put together movie, and you know, go see it.
Yeah, yeah, and well, here I think it went barely under $100 million, overseas market it did like 350 in its opening weekend, so it got, like, I've heard of a grand total of 420 million. It is financially, it broke even, it made its money back, it made its marketing back, in the overseas market. I don't know what they made, what the numbers were to market it overseas, but it is, you know, it is technically I would say a success in the foreign market. In the domestic market, however, it was not, it barely broke even. I think it had a budget of 120, and the way that you factor it, I'm told, is you take the budget, you double it for marketing, because usually the budget and the marketing are going to be the same number, depending on the film, but it was heavily marketed, not as heavily as other films, but it was, you know, well marketed. I see and still see ads for it everywhere. But then I'm probably, you know, with our social media, I'm probably accustomed to that algorithm. So of course I'm going to see that.
Right. Well, you know, Pacific Rim also did well overseas, and it didn't do so well here, but it did well enough overseas to get a sequel. It wasn't a great sequel, and the original wasn't great, but Battle Angel Alita is extremely good. I don't know if Pacific Rim gives me hope that there could be a sequel. I don't know what the numbers are for Pacific Rim. Do you know that offhand?
I'm afraid I don't.
If we could compare Pacific Rim to Alita.
Yeah, it is sort of in that same vein of, you know, big, loud, spectacle films. And although Alita was more of a subdued film, it was in many ways a large spectacle of a film. If we do see a sequel, it probably won't be for a while, you know, even if. But if they do a sequel based on what the route that they've taken with adapting it from both the manga and the OVA, I think that they would probably have to take it into a new direction. Because if I remember in the later books, one of the things that made Battle Angel Alita stand out at the time is it was the hard R of comic books. It was the hard R of mangas.
It is gruesome.
It was extremely gruesome. It was extremely dark. It was extremely It was very gut wrenching, you know, both figuratively and literally.
Oh yeah, they showed all the viscera everywhere. It was awesome.
So if they do a sequel, they're going to have to, you know, severely sanitize it. And you know, from a marketing perspective, I'm totally okay with this. Some people were arguing, you know, should the film have been a hard R instead of the PG-13? And I'm thinking, you know, even though, because let's be honest now with our modern rating stuff, the difference between an R and a PG-13 is, you know, what color is the blood?
Right.
You know, it's like in video games.
Are there wires instead of veins?
Yeah, it's like in video games, you know, the only difference between an M rating and an E rating is what the bad guys explode into when you kill them.
Well, I was rewatching Avengers Infinity War the other day, and spoiler if you haven't seen Infinity War, but at the end of the movie, when Thanos rips apart Vision's head, I mean, if he had been a real person and those had been blood vessels, you wouldn't have been able to show that. But because they were wires, you could get away with that.
Yeah, yeah. And like I was saying earlier with video games, you know, it's like either it gets an E rating if the bad guys explode into coins. If they explode into guts, then you get an M rating. And that's pretty much the same thing with movies. I don't think it doesn't need to be a hard R. Unless it's for content or sexual content, which
I mean, ideally, I would love to see an R-rated Alita movie because the manga was so R-rated, and you know that really worked. It really grounded us in that reality, really made it visceral, if you will. I would love to see that in an ideal world, but I don't think we would get a movie at the level that we got with an R rating.
Yeah.
So I would much rather it continue. If it was going to continue at that level, if it could.
Yeah, yeah. And what I enjoyed also about one of the pros for me was it borrowed from both the cartoon, the OVA, and the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the Ito's wife was not in the original.
Yeah.
And, if I'm remembering right. But she was in the movie.
Yeah, and in this one, I think in the OVA, Shirin, she exists only in the cartoon.
Right.
And in the OVA, I don't believe they were a couple, but in the movie, they sort of wrote them as a couple, and I liked that change because it allowed us to explore them more in those roles as those characters because it made sense for the film.
It deepened those characters and it connected us to them.
Yeah,
well.
It made much better sense. In the original manga, and even a little bit in the OVA, Ito, not quite a fatherly figure, he treats Alita more like she's a doll. And he kind of comes off like, well, not like a pervert or anything, but he comes off more like she's a possession. Like he just wants her to stand around and be beautiful and that's it and not have a care in the world. But of course the conflict is she is her own person and he has to come to terms with that. And of course later on he accepts that. And then of course, you know, that's of course good gets all turned asunder because drama and that's what the hard R is for.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, rewriting him in the role of a more fatherly figure was a net positive for me.
Absolutely.
It made him more relatable. It grounded him more and made him a more believable and realistic character. Christopher Waltz, in my opinion, nailed the role perfectly.
He did a great job.
Yeah.
He always does.
Yeah. I haven't seen him in much anything else, but that heavy, accent of his, you know, you can kind of like, you know, he doesn't come off as a typical white guy. You know,
Did you see Inglourious Basterds?
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay. Well, he's in that and it's good.
Yeah.
He does a great job.
Yeah. He does a great performance. One of my favorite scenes was when, he leaves the home and he has his trench coat on and he's going hunting for the first time that we see him. And at that point, you know, when you see him pull out the rocket sledgehammer, it's like, oh my God, you know, they're doing it. This is wonderful. You know, yeah. I was in hog heaven.
Yeah.
I guess they kind of, I don't know if they did they in the manga and in the OVA, they had a misdirection plot where women were being killed, and
right.
the storytelling sets you up. It makes Ito a suspect. Mm-hmm. And in this one, they kind of sideline that a bit, which I kind of understand for expediency's sake.
Right. They could have spent, I mean, if it had been a TV show, they probably could have spent a few episodes on that.
Yeah. But yeah.
They didn't have that luxury in the movie. So they just kind of got, you know, they explored it and then they moved on.
Yeah. They quickly watered it down and streamlined it, you know, to get us to the good parts where, Alita actually, you know, goes wild and unleashes herself on the bad guys and stuff. And we meet the character of Greshnek, who is in the manga, he's more of a built up character. And in the anime, he's, I guess, more of a junky, typical bad guy and stuff. And in the movie, they kind of like molded those two things, where he's a villain, but he's not so much, I would say he's part of a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And I really like what they did with him. I really like what they did with the inclusion of Nova into it, that to show that there is a larger world in.
Yeah, no, they did a great job of entwining the villains and making them all work as part of some sort of organization.
Yeah, and in the first two mangas, Nova is, I don't believe he is mentioned. He comes later in the series. But in the first, because the original manga, it's sort of Nova isn't brought in until book 3, and this one is books 1 and 2 that are condensed for story purposes. And it is great. And they include Shirin, played by Jennifer Connelly, who my sister-in-law does not like because Jennifer Connelly refused the will of the Goblin King in Labyrinth.
So wrong.
So for that, she is on her hit list. But, you know, Jennifer Connelly.
I've had a crush on Jennifer Connelly for 20 years, and I am glad to see her back in action.
Yeah, she has that sort of mature demeanor where you can totally, she's not a spring chick anymore, but she still carries that strong female empowerment thing, you know, even though she is primarily for the most part a villain.
Mm-hmm.
She's part of the bad guys, but you know, you believe that she can do all the things that she can do. You believe that she is a capable villain at that. And she is put in the role of more of the, Ido's wife, and that they were a couple and that they had history, which added depth to their characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it encapsulated the plot a bit to get it closer to home and a bit more relatable.
Yeah, and the first time that she sees Alita is in the body, the artificial body of her daughter.
Yeah.
And that adds some complexity to how she thinks of Alita.
Yeah.
And it adds depth to her character and Ito's.
Yeah. Yeah, the daughter is purely a movie creation, and it works because it gives us backstory and depth to Ito and Shirin. And I love that so much. It's in a sense kind of like westernizes it, because we get hung up on those kinds of details, and it gives us exactly what we want.
Gives us something to latch onto.
Exactly. Something relatable to latch onto. Another thing that I liked, that I kind of felt like the character of Shirin was a bit more intense in the OVA. Like, there was one scene where she's smoking a cigarette. And of course you can't have that in movies. But she's smoking a cigarette. There's a cockroach. She puts her cigarette out on the cockroach,
awesome.
You know, to show her disgust and disdain for the world that she's in. And in this one, she just smashes one with her hand and then takes off her glove. And it doesn't have the same impact.
No, not at all.
That's one of the cons in the thing, is that they try to recreate scenes. And unfortunately, they just did not have the same impact as in the OVA or in the books. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate, but I'm willing to overlook that. But it's still, in my opinion, a valid criticism.
Yeah, well, the times we live in make for faithful adaptations of, you know, those things problematic. And it's weird that we are in some ways not as free as we were, you know, 20 years ago to express ourselves.
Yeah, it's one hang up or another, unfortunately. What did you think of the character of Hugo?
I liked him. I thought he was okay. I thought he was probably not the strongest part of the movie. I felt like the Hugo from the manga was less of a sexy character, and he was boyish and obsessed with reaching the city in the sky. And, but it was his boyish optimism that you really, you focused on, and that you made him empathetic, and that Alita loved. She really, you know, he would be talking about the city and she would just be staring at him admiringly. In this one, I felt like he was a little sexier than he needed to be, but I think it made sense. Of course she would find that guy handsome and be attracted to him. And, you know, if it helps sell tickets, I'm all for it.
The character of Hugo, I think, was well portrayed. Most of the criticisms I hear is from the actor who portrayed him, that, yes, he was a bit too hunky. He looked like he stepped out of a young adult novel. That's the criticism that I've heard, and I kind of feel that's correct. I
get that, but it didn't, ruin the movie for me.
Yeah, I love that as well. The performance, the way that the character was written, unfortunately didn't quite sell it for me. Because I loved Hugo. I wanted to, I just didn't buy that. One of the criticisms that I heard from a reviewer that really stuck with me was that it was this female reviewer, and she's young. She has no idea. She's never read the source material. She's never seen the cartoon. And her impression was the dystopian world didn't look that bad. It didn't look like it was terrible or as horrible that he would want to escape it, you know, with the tenacity that he did.
Right.
In the manga and in the OVA, you know, we're given a desolate, terrible looking world. And I felt the movie, you know, it did a great job creating a post-apocalyptic world, but it didn't sell it on making it a dingy and grimy place that you want to get away from.
Well, I've got to agree with a lot of that. You know, I think that ideally I would have preferred a more Paul Verhoeven. I can't say his name.
Verhoeven.
Mm-hmm. Paul Verhoeven. I would have preferred a more Paul Verhoeven take on it, a more grimy RoboCop-y feel. And I think that James Cameron is probably capable of doing that. He has made some great, gritty, R-rated sci-fi in the past. Robert Rodriguez is no stranger to R-rated fare himself. But with the big budget movie they were trying to make, they just couldn't quite make it as grimy as they could. Yeah. And I'm glad that we got the movie that we did. Versus the $50 million movie that, you know, might have been possible with an R rating.
Yeah. It's a nitpick, but a minor nitpick. When they did the first like montage, when Alita is exploring the world, you know, we're pretty much seeing it through her eyes, and it's this picturesque Iron City is presented as a sort of, you know, a wonderful place. And
yeah, come visit Iron City.
Yeah, exactly. It looks great. I mean, you see the guy with the two arms playing the guitar. You see everyone happy. You see the cute little dog, and it's just it. you have a hard time buying that Hugo would want to escape this.
Yeah, I get that.
And I totally get that. But as far as, and that's why the final scene, unfortunately, where they're on the pipe, it unfortunately did not have the same impact that the OVA did.
Right.
It felt more like it was just going through the motions. And that is, you know, that is sad. And that's a heavy criticism that I have as well for that film. Because I was waiting for her to say, you know, you're my dream, Hugo. And that didn't happen, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, you know, points off for that. But the fact that this movie was made and that it was done in the way that it was done, I give it like almost the perfect 8 or 9 just for effort.
Oh, I give it a 9 easily. I give it an A minus. You know, it's not an A plus, but it's an A. It's a solid. It's an A. It's an A for me.
Yeah. It's definitely a great movie. And any kind of merch that I see, I try to gobble it up as hard as I can. I think Loot Crate had an exclusive figure, and I signed up for Loot Crate just to get that figure. And then as soon as I got the rest of the crap in the box, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to read this stuff. I just resold it to one of the ladies at work or something like that. It's just...
I love this movie, and I, you know, the more I think about it, you know, I've seen it twice in the theaters. I might see it again. I'm definitely buying it on Blu-ray. I talk it up to everybody I meet. You know, I just really enjoy the hell out of this movie, and I hope that it gets a sequel. I don't think it's going to, but it really deserves all the love.
Yeah.
And they put a lot of heart and enthusiasm into this movie. And it's got the solid narrative underpinnings of James Cameron, who co-wrote it and produced it. And he is nothing if not meticulous, and which is the opposite of Robert Rodriguez. As much as I love him, fellow Austinite, went to UT Film School just like I did. He's, you know, a hero of mine. And but I was very, very kind of concerned going into this movie, because Robert Rodriguez is such a, you know, fly by the seat of your pants filmmaker, mm-hmm. and James Cameron is this, you know, meticulous, take 10 years to make a movie filmmaker, and somehow the alchemy of those two visions melded very well, and we had the energy of Robert Rodriguez, but the meticulousness of James Cameron and the big budget that he can bring to something, and exactly. it all just worked really well.
Yeah, I would have to say, even if this is just a standalone film, which more than likely it probably will be, I'm okay with that, because this is, to me, it's the best example of manga being adapted to the silver screen in a good potential way.
Yeah, it was satisfying for what it was.
Yeah, before this, we had Ghost in the Shell. And Ghost in the Shell, it had a lot of, it was mislabeled, in my opinion, problematic, you know, by people who are unfamiliar with the source material for shallow, superficial reasons.
Right.
And because of that, because of the whole whitewashing controversy. And in this one, you know, and in my opinion, although I did enjoy Ghost in the Shell, I felt it wasn't the best case to make for adapting anime and manga to the silver screen, because Ghost in the Shell, it's too heavy. It's it's a very cerebral piece. The general audience is not going to get that. It's a mind fuck sold as an action film, which it was neither. And another thing,
it would have been a better TV series where they can explore these things in depth.
It felt more like a made for TV movie on the silver screen than a movie, because Battle Angel Alita, it felt like a movie. It felt like a real movie.
Oh, definitely.
Ghost in the Shell, unfortunately, it didn't hit that, and because of that, I think, you know, it leaves a manga and Japanimation adaption, it gives it an unfortunate black eye. Mm-hmm. But with this one, I think more than made up for it.
I didn't dislike Ghost in the Shell as much as a lot of people did. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a beautiful looking movie. I thought Scarlett Johansson did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And I had no problem with the, you know, the whitewashing. I, you know, as we were discussing earlier, you know, my wife is Chinese, and so I have some insight into how, you know, Asians think, and you know, they don't care.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not speaking for them, but you know, the ones that I am familiar with don't really care about that.
Yeah. Before the show, we were talking briefly about the whitewashing controversy when we were setting up. I had pointed out that the people complaining about the whitewashing, that the race change was part of the plot. And if you go to the source material, which in this case would have been the animated movie, the character uses the base model of whatever the default settings of whatever body that she inhabits. And, you know, and if the default is the Scarlett Johansson's face, then that's what she uses. You can see this in where the puppet master inhabits, you know, the same default. And in this one, the default is blonde hair, blue eyes. And those are, you know, primarily Caucasian features. So, you know, it's a non-issue if you dig deep enough, but unfortunately,
well, if you're familiar with manga at all, you know the Anglo features are not uncommon at all in manga characters.
Yeah,
and it's not something that a reader of manga would necessarily be offended by.
Yeah,
People in America, you know, particularly on the left, are very sensitive to these things. And they made a bigger issue out of it than it probably needed to be.
For you know, historical purposes, manga is largely influenced by Betty Boop, which is a Western character. But since then, it has grown into its own thing. And if you look at manga,
is that true? Was manga inspired by Betty Boop?
Yeah, that she was a large proponent of the style. Why you see Astro Boy with the big eyes, and a lot of the early mangas,
I did not know that.
They have large eyes, and that was largely from Betty Boop in particular, because she was one of the first ones who, you know, who made animation sexy, mm-hmm. you know, in a way. And that's kind of that.
So sexy it helped lead to the ban, and that's when they started to regulate films.
Yes. She's a pioneer. And fun little fact, the inspiration for Betty Boop specifically was a jazz performer, a female black woman, who the Betty Boop was a caricature of her. And she was a black singer. I forget her name off the top of my head, but she was, you know, she had the short hair. She did the singing and stuff like that. And for adaptions, you know, they kind of made Betty Boop into a poodle, but it was based off of her, and she was a woman of color. So technically Betty Boop is a woman of color.
Well, all the Betty Boop cartoons are really grounded in that music, you know, the black music of that era.
Yeah, the jazz era and stuff like that. And it's, you know, I mean, Betty Boop, of course, is a fantastic institution. It's hard to hate Betty Boop because, you know, she's just, it's great. I love Betty Boop. But to get back on track here, the manga and anime has sort of become its own thing now. And all the characters are, you know, for the most part today, outrageous. They're so outrageous. They have big spiky purple hair that goes up for miles and stuff like that. And getting hung up on ethnicities, I think, is a disservice, because these characters are so radical that anyone can fill their shoes, you know, provided that you got enough hair gel and hair dye, that, you know, it's a non-issue, but unfortunately, a lot of our pop culture decide to try to make it an issue.
Well, and everything has to be political these days.
Yeah. And what gets me, what really gets under my skin is, Battle Angel Alita delivered on what the left, the politicized people, the problematic naysayers, everything they claim they want was in Battle Angel Alita. A strong
representation,
characters,
powerful female.
Yeah. Powerful female, people of color representation. They had all that in spades in this movie, and yet it goes largely ignored and unnoticed and underappreciated. And yet we're told that, well, we're waiting for all of that in Captain Marvel. And I'm saying, well, have you seen Alita? I mean, it was either 2 or 3 weeks between the release of Alita and Captain Marvel. A good month between their release. And leading up to Captain Marvel's release, people were saying like, oh, it's about time, you know, women, this is your time, finally.
Yeah, no, I remember that too. I tried to engage people in conversations. Well, we just had Alita.
Yeah, exactly. And I was saying the same thing as well. It's like, have you seen Alita? You're getting all that and more. And also, Alita, the actress that plays Alita, is Hispanic, you know, so you're getting a powerful woman of color.
Absolutely.
And her background and stuff like that, you know, it's inconsequential to the plot, really, because she's a strong female character regardless of the ethnicity of the person that plays her. And Rosa Salazar, she did a fantastic job. I mean, I've seen behind the scenes where it's just her in the pinstripe suit with the dots on her face.
I've seen that too. Yeah, and she is Alita.
Yeah, and even though Alita is a, you know, CGI reconstruction, you know, it's her performance that gives the character life. And for me, Alita, the character, was so endearing. She was charming.
Absolutely.
She was emotionally vulnerable. She was strong. And, you know, you wanted to protect her, but she could take care of herself.
She really could.
She was someone that you cheered for. You cheered for her. You wanted her to win. You wanted her to get her dreams. You wanted her to get the guy and all that stuff. And she was this selfless, giving character, you know, who she could do it all. And that's, you know, stuff that people claim they want to see. And here it is in a nice little package, but it doesn't have Marvel or Disney on it. So it's like, oh, duh, who cares? Like, no, shut up. You're being a butt about this, you know, to those critics.
People were lined up to get behind Captain Marvel for political reasons when, you know, Alita had all the qualities they were looking for, except I don't think it advanced the narrative they wanted. And it could have been that Alita was too sensitive. She was too, you know, feminine, if you will, even though she was a total badass. You know, that's not what they wanted. They wanted a strong, unemotional woman. Although, paradoxically, Captain Marvel in the movie is criticized for being too emotional, although she doesn't display that.
Yeah, if you watch the movie, or at least the actress that plays her does it. Yeah, let's go ahead and just step into Captain Marvel. There's a final point in Alita that I want to get to, but in getting into Captain Marvel, we'll be able to reach around and get back to that. With Captain Marvel, if it weren't for the political hubbub that started, you know, beforehand, I kind of feel this movie would have gotten a lukewarm response.
Yeah.
It was okay. Promotion is, this is a great movie. This is going to be the greatest movie, the most, you know, powerfulest character in the Marvel universe, this, that, and the other thing. This is everything in the kitchen sink. And you walk out of it, you say, you know, I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it was okay.
Well, and, you know, the friend that I saw it with, and he's on the left, and he said that he would put it on the same level as Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I think that's probably about right. It was a watchable Marvel movie. I think that Ant-Man and the Wasp is superior because they did a good job in realizing Ant-Man's character. Yeah. And he's a likable character that you come out of the movie thinking, hey, I like that guy.
Yeah.
I would like to see more stuff from that guy. The Wasp was pretty good. And, you know, the other characters were reasonable. Leaving the theater after seeing Captain Marvel, I didn't even really know who she was or like her or have any – I wasn't rooted in her character at all. They just didn't do a very good job of realizing that character in the way that they did, you know, Wonder Woman or Alita or even, you know, Black Widow.
Yeah. I think that's being a bit too generous, but that's just me. I would have to say
probably.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, when, because let's face it, these political hubbubs are done purely for marketing purposes, and it's kind of the point that now that they're attacking that industries are attacking their fan base, you know, yeah, for purely political reasons.
If you disagree with a movie, you're a toxic fan.
Yeah, and it's I mean, you want these people's money. I'd say, and I think I think film has hit its rock star base, its 80s rock star base, where, you know, because if you remember during the 80s, you would hear horrible stories about rock stars spitting on their fans and treating their fans like dirt, and the fans still loved them.
Right.
And right. I think that's what's happening here is we're getting rock star, you know, Marvel and comic book movies are becoming the new rock stars. Mm-hmm. And I'm just waiting for that to phase out when, you know, industries start, you know, treating their fans, you know, I'm not saying particularly the white neckbeard fans, because I've seen a lot of criticism of Captain Marvel that I feel is largely unfounded from, you know, the supposed neckbeards. And, you know, I kind of,
for sure it goes both ways.
Yeah, exactly. It goes both ways. What I feel though is that the movie is just okay, but it was sold as, you know, a game changer, and it isn't.
It was sold as this big moment,
yeah,
in America where women would ascend. Well, what about Wonder Woman that happened, yeah, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we already
What about happened? What about Tomb Raider? What about all, you know, Wonder Woman had a TV show back in, what was it, the 70s or 80s?
Yeah, it's been, you know, there, done that.
I think women ascended a while ago.
Yeah, and one of the criticisms that I've heard that I felt was, you know, laughable was someone, a no-name somebody tweeted that James Cameron doesn't know how to write strong women. And of course, exactly.
Good point, whoever that was.
Yeah, this is the same person who brought us Aliens Ripley. This is the same person who brought us Sarah Connor. This is the same person who brought us, you know, I'm sure that there are others, but those are the two that stick out the most.
Hey, because, Alita.
Yeah, and Alita as well. And those are the two previous ones are the two strongest, most blockbuster. They're the standard. Whenever anyone says, you know, strong, powerful woman, they bring up either Ripley or Sarah Connor. And, you know, he's responsible for that. So that idea, that criticism is extremely laughable.
And
it's just, and with Captain Marvel bringing this back around, is that, in my ultimate criticism of the character of Captain Marvel, now, Brie Lawson, if she had just kept her mouth shut, I feel this movie would have, I don't know if it would have performed any better, but the largest thing that this got started, because she had said that she doesn't want to see white straight men on the press tour. She doesn't want to, she doesn't care about the opinion of straight white men.
You know, I think that actually helped, you know, sadly. I think it gave people something to talk about. It gave something to people to chew on. And it gave people an excuse to get behind what she was saying. And probably propelled the movie to greater heights than it deserved. Because it made it even more of a political thing than it already was. And there was some politics baked into the movie. But the movie itself isn't too political, although it does go there. But it's the meta-narrative surrounding the movie that really drove that home. And part of that was her comments.
Yeah. And the thing is well, if we see that with – they previously tried this before with Black Panther. Now, as far as I know, there was no fire starter for Black Panther. There was no incident that said, you know, if you don't love this movie, you're racist. I think that just started organically.
Yeah.
In the Twitterverse or whatever. But none of the actors or actresses, as far as I know, really pushed that, you know, if you don't like this movie, you're racist. I'm sure some in passing probably made that comment. But the movie itself, Black Panther, would have been a success whether the hubbub was there or not, because it had a built-in audience. People were waiting to go see it. I mean, even, and I'm sure the whole, you know, pushing a black superhero in this time, you know, even though we had Blade prior, you know, it, you know, I don't see anything wrong with that or anything, you know, it's cool and it's good. And I think it does a great job of introducing superheroes to new audiences.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm totally, you know, down with inclusion and stuff like that. I'm not against it. I'm just critical on the condition of if you're going to be inclusionary, make sure that the whatever superficial thing you're trying to promote is a part of the character, but is not the character.
And Black Panther did have an advantage in being a somewhat better movie.
Exactly.
Black Panther was a legitimately a pretty good movie. I mean, it wasn't great. I would give it a B or a B plus. But it was a solid entry in the Marvel franchise, and it did a good, you know, well, I want to say it did a good job at world building, but there's some really problematic things with the world. I don't know if it really makes sense, if it's cohesive, but whatever. It introduced us to a new, cool culture, and they did a lot of exploration of that culture. And, you know, as a world builder myself in my epic fantasy and science fiction novels, go to Jack Connor, Amazon. you know, I really appreciate that. And I give it, you know, bonus points just for that. But in addition to that, it was a really solid movie. I feel like if the third act had been as good as the second act, you know, I could even give it an A.
Oh, absolutely.
But unfortunately, Captain Marvel, the writers just kind of let that movie down. I don't know what was going on there. Yeah,
I think my biggest, just to skirt back to Black Panther for just a second, my biggest criticism was of Black Panther was when they were in Wakanda, Wakanda only had one street.
But if they're going to develop war rhinos, why are they only developing three war rhinos? Shouldn't there be like 3,000 war rhinos? You know, there's all sorts of little nitpicks I have with the world building in Black Panther, you know. So, you know, it's this advanced society, but they decide who the king is going to be by who can physically kill each other. Really?
Yeah.
So,
and we can only have one Market Street in the entire nation, only one Market Street.
So I have some major issues with the reality of the world they created for that movie. But as a movie, it was a solid, entertaining movie with a character that I had a good sense of and a new, interesting culture that I had a good sense of when I left the theater.
Yeah, and Captain Marvel, I don't think they didn't have to do much world building. They had establish a pre-Guardians Kree home world.
Okay, yeah. See, they did need to establish, you know, the state of the universe. And I didn't understand so a big element of the plot is the Skrulls having developed faster than light travel. But it seems like all of the players can get from planet to planet with a snap of their fingers, you know, through the grid. I don't know exactly the jump points. However.
Yeah, the little jump points that were introduced in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but seem to be absent in Guardians 1 and Thor. Of course, Thor had the Bifrost, so they didn't need that.
Right. Now, I'll allow Thor to get away with that because they had the Bifrost.
Yeah.
But if they are going to have jump points be a thing, and the Skrulls are going to try to develop faster than light travel to possibly get off of the grid, now if you're going to do that, you have to say that. They never said that. And so, who controls the grid? Are there just a certain number of jump points, and that they're controlled by the Kree or something, and that's why the Skrulls had to go off the grid. Anyway, so there's some...
Yeah, really, it complicates it.
Yeah. So they never explain the plot very well in Captain Marvel to start with.
Well, it was...
And what was the Ronan? What was his relationship to Jude Law and the Kree? And so there's multiple accusers because they said Ronan of the accusers. So I do wish they had developed the universe a little bit more fully.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and who knows what happens by the time Ronan becomes the sole accuser or whatever it is. And I like that they brought back some of I like that they brought back Ronan. Of course, he didn't do anything. They just brought him back, you know, just to sneer from the sidelines.
Yeah, I kind of feel like if you're going to bring Ronan back, you need to kind of give him something more to do.
Yeah.
He just serves as a set piece for, you know, something for Captain Marvel to blow up at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Captain Marvel, you know, like I was saying earlier, she was flawless and vulnerable throughout the entire plot. You know, she was never wrong and she was never at fault. I mean, and if she was presented as wrong, it wasn't her fault. Like when she's beating up the old lady in the subway, people are trying to stop her. But, you know, that's because that character is a Skrull. You know, she's not at fault for that, for them misunderstanding why she's beating up this old woman who can somersault and spin kick and do, you know, jump dives through glass and stuff like that. You know, that's inconsequential. And when she discovers that, you know, the Kree are actually that they were the bad guys all along, dun, dun, dun. She says she's sorry and starts crying, but technically she is not at fault. We were presented parts where she's supposed to be vulnerable, but I don't believe it because it's not like with Alita. You know, we see parts where she is vulnerable, where she is sad, where she's trying her hardest to do things and things just aren't going her way. And we feel for her. With Captain Marvel, I didn't quite feel for her. Or
no, I never felt for Captain Marvel the whole movie. The actress Brie Larson just played her very flat.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't dislike her exactly, but mm-hmm. I never had any emotional hook for her. And a lot of that was just her ability to convey emotion and her lack of a star presence. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was the writing. If the writers had given her more to work with, like, you know, I was saying earlier, they tried to give her some sort of arc where she was supposedly being told she was too emotional, but we never got to see why they said that. And then she had to overcome that or find out that it was okay to be emotional, but we never actually saw that development. Anyway, so there are things they kind of set up to work with that they never did. A better actress, I think, could have elevated the material and made, you know, own that character in a way that, you know, Brie Larson just couldn't. You know, yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, Katie Sackhoff and Battlestar Galactica. You know, she has a lot of star presence. When she's on the screen, you're looking at her, she is owning that material. And Brie Larson just did not. She was upstaged by Sam Jackson and the cat the whole movie. I mean, Sam Jackson had better chemistry with the cat than he did Brie Larson.
Yeah, and that's something that I noticed too, was throughout the plot, she was just going through the motions, going from point A to point B. Again, like with my criticism of Ghost in the Shell, it felt like a really big episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It didn't feel like a movie.
Yeah. And not a good agent, not a good episode, just a run of the mill.
Yeah.
Not even run of the mill episode.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it was cool to see Coulson back, you know, and stuff like that, you know, but it just,
Oh, but what happened to Nick Fury's eye? Oh my God.
Some of the criticisms that I've heard from not from the left, but from the other side, I guess the only way I know how to register it is, you know, the neckbeard society, is that they were complaining about stuff that I felt were non-issues, like, oh, you know, having Nick Fury having his eye scratched by a cat ruins it. Or something like that.
It doesn't ruin it. It was just kind of lame.
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I thought it was funny, but the part where they really didn't quite explain, I don't know if they needed to, because how Mar-Vell got a hold of the cube from Tony Stark. Now, she was in the military and she was a military scientist, so I'm pretty sure that's how that happened, but I would have liked to have seen. You know,
yeah, that's another one of those state of the universe questions that they didn't really explain very well. Maybe that was on the cutting room floor somewhere, and they did write it, and they just cut that out.
I don't know. Because the actor who plays, I think both the actors who played young and old Howard Stark, I don't know if they're under contract anymore. But it would have been nice to have seen a Howard Stark scene where he's handing off the cube to Mar-Vell. And
that would have made too much sense for this movie.
Yeah, and you know, and then have some exposition explained. But the, you know, and that's a minor nitpick, but it's not, you know, world destroying, universe destroying for me, as other critics have said.
No, I mean, I don't think this was an awful movie. It didn't ruin anything for me. It was just, you know, a subpar Marvel movie with a lot of sloppy writing.
Yeah.
And not a very good realization of the main character. Yeah.
It felt like I've heard this criticism. It felt like a phase two movie. And they're pretty much in like phase three or four now.
Right.
And, you know, it felt like a movie that should have come out in like 5-6 years ago. And they kind of sandwiched this in, you know, just to introduce her into the Marvel Universe, which, you know, okay, you know, but it just, I don't know.
If they ever save the day at the end and in Endgame, that's going to be kind of lame.
Yeah.
If they introduce her at the last minute only so she can kick Thanos' butt, that's, you know, that's, I'm going to totally butcher the pronunciation, but Deus Ex Machina. Machina.
Yeah.
Deus. Anyway, that's what it is. God in the machine. If they have introduced her only for her to serve as that function in Endgame, that's just poor storytelling.
Yeah, I've heard from another podcast, Holy Nerdy Podcast. They said that someone leaked one of the trailer. And there's a part of dialogue where they say, you know, the characters are getting together. They're about to go face Thanos. And they say, you know, how do we know that things aren't going to happen exactly like they did last time? And then Captain Marvel says, well, you didn't have me this time, or you don't have me last time. And, you know, that sounds like, you know, like, oh, okay. Yeah. You're kind of full of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is.
and the thing is, you know, I mean, I want the character to be a success, because to me, this character is a step to a better character, which is Miss Marvel, the Kamala Khan, who takes up the mantle of
Miss Marvel.
Yeah, she's, if you're going to read any Miss Marvel, I suggest you read the first year. And that's great because it introduces the character, and she's this sort of all American otaku girl who's like this ultimate fangirl. Totally relatable. She's like, she's Muslim and stuff, but she comes off as completely 100% American. You know, she's like, she's just, there's this one point where she's sniffing these chili dogs or something, and they have bacon on them. She's like, oh, yummy, delicious, infidel meat or bacon. And she just loves the smell of bacon, and she loves comic books. She loves, you know, Tony Stark and superheroes and all that stuff.
Yeah. And I see what you mean. Just, yeah. It sounds like a cool character.
It's a relatable, believable, likable character. And I know to get to that character, we have to sit through Captain Marvel. And
well, you know, I read one of the Captain Marvel graphic novels, and it was the one that was published around the time that Guardians of the Galaxy 2 came out. And it was very much in that vein. And they really made her a likable, snarky, kind of punky character. And she was a lot of fun, just bouncing around in space, having adventures in space. It wasn't like the best written comic of all time, but her character was very likable. And I was actually looking forward to her in the movie, but then I saw the trailers and I just said, you know, that's not the same character.
Yeah.
She's just flat and wooden. And, you know, maybe it'll work out. Maybe that's just a bad trailer. Maybe the movie will do a better job. Just like Alita, you know, the movie really made her character work, where I had problems in the trailer. But no, that is not the way it worked. She was just a very flat character that's all powerful and without flaws and kind of uninteresting.
Yeah, and anything bad that nothing is ever her fault.
Wouldn't be empowering.
Yeah, and it's the thing is, you know, having a character make mistakes and stuff, that's how growth happens. That's how and growth is that's relatable. To
growth, Captain America doesn't do growth, or Captain Marvel.
Well, she levels up. She goes Super Saiyan when she realizes that she's been lied to, which again is something that is not her fault. you know, I felt myself more drawn to the character of the Supreme Intelligence than Captain Marvel. I was actually cheering for the Supreme Intelligence. I loved how they portrayed the Supreme Intelligence in this one. I don't know. I don't read a lot of the Captain Marvel comics per se. I bought a series of graphic novels and they were okay. It was a time travel arc that she was doing. But in this one, in mostly the cartoons and stuff is where I see them have the Supreme Intelligence. And the Supreme Intelligence in the cartoons is basically a gigantic jar with a gigantic brain in it. Wow. And that is just, ugh.
And I'd much rather have Annette Bening.
Yeah, and with this one, what they did instead was they had it where it is this Supreme AI that they run with. And since they do the whole Matrix AI thing, they can do anything they want. So the Supreme Intelligence coming up as Annette Bening, I loved that. I thought that was so clever and so cool, and I wanted to see more of that. I wanted to see more of her interacting with the Supreme Intelligence, and I hope that they bring back the Supreme Intelligence in the form of Annette Bening in the future. But as far as Annette Bening as Mar-Vell, well, we really didn't have enough time to form a relationship with her or have her built up as a character in
Not
this film. It's like we're told in exposition she is XYZ, and we're told that the reason that Annette Bening shows up as the Supreme Intelligence is because the Supreme Intelligence is supposed to take the representation of who you admire most. And in the film, what was her name again? Carl Danvers. Yeah, Carl only gets to know Mar-Vell for like maybe 2 or 3 days before they go on a mission or something like that. She basically accepts an assignment, and that is their relationship. You know, boss and pilot, you know.
I'm not familiar with the comics, you know, how they met. What was it like in the comics?
Well, in the comics, as far as what I can recall, Mar-Vell was, you know, originally a male. He was a scientist who I don't know if he was a scientist or a warrior, who came to Earth, and he was under the guise of, you know, he would turn into Marvel, Captain Marvel, and save the day. And he was fighting the Kree, and the Kree were the bad guys. And in a accident, and someone was making some kind of, you know, bomb or something. And in the explosion, his powers transferred over to Carol Danvers, and Carol Danvers was his sidekick. You know, was sort of his, you know, his, she was Steve Trevor to Mar-Vell. And then through some kind of explosion, her powers transferred over to her, and she became, you know, Miss Marvel, and then later took on the mantle of Captain Marvel.
So a little bit more of a complicated backstory.
Yeah. It's, but still the major plot point is, you know, she got her powers from Captain Marvel. The point is the explosion, she got her powers from an explosion, from super science gone wrong. And in this one, you know, she got her powers from the cube instead of right. Marvel per se, but Mar-Vell was there as sort of a mentor, even if it was for a day. And that's more of a criticism that I have than rather, oh, the cat scratched Nick or some stuff like that.
Right. And, yeah. Would that one day or brief time that she spent with Mar-Vell really make the impression on her that when she met the ultimate intelligence, that's the form that it would take?
Exactly. And that is my criticism. I kind of felt like the Supreme Intelligence should have taken the guise of Jude Law, because he was more of a mentor to her. We saw the relationship build. I loved Jude Law as the character he was. When I first saw the trailers, I thought he was going to be Mar-Vell.
Yeah, me too. I thought he was going to have a lot more to do, and I wish they had given him more to do, because it seemed like the emotional stakes for her and her arc, you know, at the end when he says, let's fight, and she says, no, you know, I don't have anything to prove. That was her arc, And if they had just explored that more and given her that arc more, you know, put some more meat on those bones, it really would have made that story a lot more satisfying. Instead, they had to bring in Ronan, and, kind of divide the villains. And if they had instead been able to give Jude Law a little bit more to do and give his character more interaction with Carol Danvers, then she would have had something really emotional to overcome. And that final moment when she says, "No, I don't have anything to prove," that would have been a lot more resonant.
Yeah, it's like the pipe scene in Alita. They could have done so much more with it.
And, but at least there was a character that was tracked throughout the movie and that we knew that she had an emotional connection to.
Exactly. And instead we have Ronan who comes in and he's, again, just something for her to punch. And another thing of trying to build the character of Carol Danvers, they introduce her best friend, which is Monica Rambeau, who is the mother I think it's Michelle Rambeau, or I'm getting this wrong, but still the daughter is supposed to be the 1980s representation of Captain Marvel. Cause during the 80s, Captain Marvel then became a black woman with, I think, magnetic superpowers or something of that nature. I'm not too familiar with that character.
I've seen the comic book character, the covers. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but that for a lot of people, that was Captain Marvel. That was their first introduction to Captain Marvel, because Marvel, the Kree guy, that was in the 60s and 70s. And, you have to dig way deep to get into that. But for a lot of people, I guess in our generation, their first Captain Marvel would have been Michelle Rambeau. And they introduced her best friend, which is Maria Rambeau, who, I guess is supposed to help her build her character by giving her someone to emote to. And
they tried, and
it kind of, it kind of fell flat. I mean, and this isn't a criticism of the actress that played her, because, the actress, I'm sure, is great. And it seemed like this character was just, plunked in to fill an algorithm, that she was just she was the black character to make the white girl seem cool to black people, to give them that sort of fantasy, like, hey, black people think I'm cool, look at my black best friend, type of thing. And that just, it fell flat. I mean, the actress and that character, they did okay. They did well enough when it was just them, when it was Monica and Nick Fury, fighting the Kree and the ship. Yeah, I was down with that. I liked that. I liked seeing them doing stuff, because you felt for those characters. There was peril there because they were just human, and they were vulnerable and relatable and all that stuff. But her relationship to Carol, it's like she was just there just to be Carol's, you get them, girl. That's the only
person. Yeah, she was fine. She was an okay character and an okay actress. I've heard a lot of glowing praise for her.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything bad to say about her. I don't think that she stole the screen or the spotlight.
Well,
unfortunately,
to me, she was more
Brie Larson.
Yeah. To me, she was more relatable than she dished out a better performance than Brie Larson.
I liked her character more than Carol Danvers.
Yeah, and that character had less to work with too. And what I felt was sad was that there had been a 7-year gap between when Carol Danvers disappeared and was taken by the Kree and when she saw her best friend again. There was a 7-year gap. Her daughter had grown up from, a toddler to a young preteen. And during that time, that character made zero growth. As far as we know, she didn't get a new best friend. She did not get a husband. She did not settle down. She did not have more kids. It's like time froze and then
she knew that Carol Danvers would return.
Yeah, she
was just waiting.
They just picked up where they left off. And, and I'm like, that, humans don't do that. She's gonna have like a new circle of friends, a new career. You know, I mean, yeah, she was working on planes and stuff. Yeah, so she's always going to be in aviation of, in some sort. But I wanted to see her, you know, like, you know, she's supposed to have more in her life. It's more like the whole point of her life was to be Carol Danvers' BFF.
How can you have more in your life than that, Chris? Come on.
Okay, you got me there.
Yeah, but you know what I didn't get? Okay, so the Skrulls show up, and one of them is in the backyard with her daughter, menacing her daughter, you know, supposedly. You know, for a moment we think they're the villains, and she is aware that there's an alien, a sinister alien, with her daughter outside. But then a couple seconds later, they come in, and she's just fine with it. You know, talking about, you know, the Rambo character. And I don't think a real woman would be like that. No, you know, motherfucker, you were just out there menacing my kid, you know, screw you.
I mean, as far as what I know of mothers, that's mama bear territory. You don't get into that zone. That is the deadliest place in the universe.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're just pretending to menace somebody's kid, you know, which was the case in the movie, but it's still, you don't pretend to menace somebody's child and then sit down for tea with them.
Yeah. Yeah. She totally should have gone off on them. That's a good valid point. And this is a case of where they have this character that they could have done so much more with, but they didn't. And I kind of liken that back to, Mahershala Ali, who played Vector in Battle Angel Alita. I kind of felt like he was in the same boat, that he was this great, he's this great actor. You give him this sort of supporting character role, and I kind of feel like there's wasted potential there.
That, oh, definitely. Yeah, I think Vector had a lot more to do in the manga.
Yeah, and in this one, as we know from Mahershala Ali, he played Cottonmouth in Luke Cage and
great job.
Season 1. And for me, that was the highlight of the series. I loved watching him just, you know, emote and perform and grow as a character. He was more interesting than Luke Cage. And in that he had arcs, he had growth, he had vulnerability. I mean, his bad guys, when they killed Pop, you know, he got pissed off and, you know, he was vulnerable. He was everything that I want to see in characters. And, Mahershala Ali, you know, emoted all that perfectly. So he is a fully capable actor. And I would have loved to have seen him have more, growth and depth in Alita. But unfortunately, I guess for time and plot purposes, he had to be, you know, just, he was just, henchman number two. And that was, you know,
maybe henchman number one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I think henchman number one was, you know, Goroshnik or the bad guy. But he was like, you know.
In the hierarchy, though, he was the boss.
Okay, so he would be the first mini boss.
Yeah.
To Nova. And I kind of felt like that potential was wasted there. The same thing with the actress who played Monica Rambeau is that, yeah, she's, I suppose, I'm not too familiar with her work, but I'm sure she was good in the performance that she did with what she was given, what little she was given to work with.
Yeah, she wasn't given very much.
Yeah, and I felt like.
I will say that the actor that played Vector, you know, really stole the screen whenever he was on.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I don't feel like the actress that played Rambeau brought that level of star power to the role. Not that she was bad. I just felt, you know, he was better.
Yeah. Comparatively, yeah. But, you know, I mean, if you're going to have the best friend that invested in the story, I felt they could have done more with it. But what I, you know, maybe they did do more with it. And it just didn't resonate with me because of how flat Carol Danvers as a character was presented.
Well, let's put it this way. Rambeau was no goose. Of course, Carol Danvers was no Maverick either. So
yeah, and that's just that sort of, you know, wasted potential that I just it's, you know, I mean they could have done so much more, but they didn't, and there was, I think they were stuck on, you know, they had a certain amount of beats they had to keep up with, and you know, I mean, because I think, what was it, like, Captain Marvel was like, what, in 2 hours or something like that? And it just whooshed right by. It just, it went by so quick. It was over before you know it. And, you know, I guess that's good pacing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I liked how in the world building that they perfectly recreated the 90s. I loved that.
Hey, I love the 90s. I love going back to Blockbuster. Miss Blockbuster.
Yeah, and the characters, you believed them in that world. I mean, when Nick Fury came up and told her about, you know they got a return slot, you know, and it's,
I love seeing Nick Fury again and Coulson again, and yeah, Nick Fury stole the movie. He was absolutely the best part of the movie. Him and the cat. I think they need their own buddy cop movie.
Yeah.
Spinoff. They need to make that happen. And I'm really encouraged to see, them de-aging Sam Jackson. Maybe they can do more with Nick Fury, a younger Nick Fury, or other characters. I mean, you know, I was joking the other day, they can need a de-age Arnie and have another Conan movie or a Commando 2, you know, yeah. The highest and best use of that technology.
Or at least have him, you know, pass the mantle on to someone else or something like that. He needs to have a last hurrah as Conan. You know, Conan needs to go out with a bang or
yeah,
something.
I would love to see a King Conan.
Yeah, and
I'm not even, you know, I love Conan the Barbarian. I'm a huge Robert E. Howard fan and a fan of that character.
Yeah, and that's a great, you bring up a great point that is the best way that some actors and actresses are best executed. And I think with the example of Arnold as Conan, you know, he's better off as a presence. Because right. In Terminator and in Conan, he wasn't doing a lot of acting. He wasn't, he didn't have the most lines, but he was a presence. And in this one, you know, with Brie Lawson, you know, she felt like she was someone who I guess she didn't have any presence.
No, I mean, for to be a hero, I think you really need, you know, like Robert Downey Jr. You know, just owns the screen whenever he's on the screen. Mm-hmm. You know, almost all, in fact, I think all of the Marvel heroes so far, even this, most of the side characters, you know, Hawkeye, you know, maybe not, but, almost all of the characters, they really inhabit those roles beautifully. And the actors do such a good job, and the writers typically do such a good job writing for those characters, even if the movies themselves aren't always great. You always love those characters. And, Scarlett Johansson does a great job in Black Widow, and she is so much more charismatic and owns the screen in a way that Brie Larson just can't do.
Even in Black Panther, you know, the female characters there were great characters. You know, like I remember talking about how much I loved the little sister, that she was so believable and so relatable. And they have... And that's the thing that gets me is that, you know, the Captain Marvel character, although I can understand why they want to expand their roster, but it's kind of unnecessary. But when you're trying to fill that role, you're expanding the roster because you need more powerful women when they have, you know, equally or should I say more emotionally stronger women in their roster already. That they're not making use of.
Yeah, where's that Black Marvel? Where's that Black Widow movie?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean,
why wasn't that made 10 years ago?
that's what this movie should have been, and I can understand a lot of, you know, the criticisms of being, you know, this. I would rather have a Black Widow movie 10 years ago than a Captain Marvel movie now, and I have to agree with that sentiment. That it's okay, you know, it's an okay movie, but the hubbub that came before this movie should have been Oscar worthy with all the drama surrounding it.
And Black Panther somewhat lived up to the hype.
Exactly.
Captain Marvel did not.
Yeah. And it's sad because what's going to happen is this is going to influence the next generation of creators out there. You know,
I hope not.
And even the people, you know, people are going to look at this and say, this is what excellence is. I should emote this. And it's, you know, it you know, and we're going to have a lot of new media coming out that's going to fall flat, when a better example would be something like Wonder Woman.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'm really worried that going forward, you know, for a movie to be successful, it's going to have some sort of political agenda. And I think that's why Alita Battle Angel didn't do as well, in part because it wasn't pushing any particular political narrative. It was just a good movie.
Yeah, and if it decided to push the political agenda, it would have won. It would have met the requirements of the political agenda superficially, and been at its heart a good film. So it would have been a better champion for the cause than Captain Marvel was.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, they could have gone with a political angle for that and pushed it in a political way. And you could have found ways to make that political and enhance those elements.
Yeah, and not feel stupid they didn't for pushing it
politically.
Yeah, and not feel like an idiot because you're pushing a superior product. You know, it's leading by a good example. And fortunately, we did not get that. That's not what happened. And, you know, like I said, moving forward, I'm worried that we're just going to get more subpar stuff that we're going to be told is excellence. And I think that's the new marketing ploy now, is that studios are afraid that their stuff is subpar, so they have to manufacture a political agenda for it. We saw that happen with Ghostbusters, and now it's sort of, they're taking that tried and true formula and pushing it on Captain Marvel, where it's like, you know, this isn't a movie, it's a political movement. Social movement. And, you know, and
where was all this for Wonder Woman?
Yeah, Wonder Woman, they kind of tried to push it, but there was no controversy The Gal Gadot, she was this, even behind the scenes, she was this encouraging, you know, soft-spoken, you know, inspiring person, you know, in addition to the character. You know, she was doing everything. She wasn't dividing people.
Right.
The only division that I saw was that her Israeli ethnicity offended people. And that is, you know, that is just fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that she was in the Israeli military because, you know, that's just the culture that they're there.
Everybody has to be in the military.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it.
Over there.
And it's just. I don't want to use the term missed opportunity, but if they had done that, they would have been justified in that. And I think afterwards, you know, there was some political agenda pushing when Rotten Tomatoes readjusted their algorithm or whatever to make Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You're talking. Yeah. I thought you were going to the Rotten Tomatoes Captain Marvel controversy.
Yeah. Well, even in that, they had done that prior with Wonder Woman, where they had tried to readjust their thing so that Wonder Woman would always be on top. And I think, you know, people were promoting, you know, getting with the Wonder Woman, trying to push it as a movement after the fact, but it was already like, it was a good enough movie, and the actress, she wasn't stirring up any trouble, you know, other than existing.
Yeah, it didn't need that.
Yeah, it didn't need that. And I think that's where they kind of, you know, saw that started there. And in this one, they executed it because Captain Marvel does need the controversy to sell it. And unfortunately, we're getting to the point now that criticism is hate speech now. And that is just.
Absolutely. Yeah, and if you have criticism, you're a toxic fan. You're a troll, a woman hating troll of some sort.
Yeah, and on this thing, you know, we've all, you know, I mean, I'm sure that this might be labeled as trolling by some, but everything that we've lined up, we've lined up, you know, I think articulately, we've presented alternatives, solutions. We've presented examples of why, you know, and compared and contrasted to what we feel are better and superior works that are in the same vein, you know. So to come out and say that, you know, that, by being critical, we're being trolling, is it's a reach. It's a, I guess it would, the term is straw man argument.
Yeah, you know, for me, the only toxic fans are the fans that attack other fans, calling them toxic. you know, the only toxicity in the fandom is this political divide where, you know, half the audience is calling the other half misogynist, or what have you, depending on the week.
Yeah.
And, I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah. And it does happen on both sides where that the other side is overcorrecting, you know, that, oh, I'm being told by the actress that I suck, so I have to hate this movie, and I have to oversell my hatred of this movie.
Captain Marvel is the worst movie ever because Brie Larson said, it's a watchable. I mean, all the Marvel movies pretty much are fun, watchable movies, and you know this one is no exception. It's just a kind of a subpar Marvel movie with a weak main character.
Yeah, it could have been better, and we illustrate why and how. And it's, you know, and the thing is, you know, and in some cases by overcorrecting, they're kind of playing into that, you know, see, I told you they were trolls. Here's my example of trolling, you know, and it's just, it's like a snake that eats itself.
I do have some hope in the realization of the character of Captain Marvel, because the Russo brothers, you know, who are doing the Avengers Infinity War in Endgame, they are going to be the ones writing and directing her in Endgame. So maybe there's time for them to course correct that character and make her a better, more likable, well-realized character. And then going into her own standalone adventures from that point, they can build on the work that the Russo brothers have done, or Russo brothers have done for Endgame.
Yeah, because they did an outstanding job with Winter Soldier. I think it was Winter Soldier theirs.
I think
Winter Soldier was theirs. It is still, I mean, Winter Soldier was pretty much the cornerstone for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for like 3 seasons. They kept going back and referring to that movie. Their go-to for any kind of inspiration was Winter Soldier. They know what they're doing. And Infinity War is an example of that. You know, it had so much going on, but it didn't feel like any of it dragged any of it down.
And so, it never neglected any of the characters. Yeah. I'm a little bit annoyed by what they did with the Star-Lord, but but other than that one, you know, exception, they were bang on with their characters. And I have some hope that they can do more justice to Carol Danvers in Endgame, but we'll see.
I'm not trying to, you know, hate on the actress because, ooh, she was mean. I'm trying to, you know, just her performance was just, it didn't serve the material that she was given, and she wasn't given a lot of good material to work with.
Well, sure. Well, no. Sam Jackson has said stuff that I don't like and disagree with, but I still love him as an actor, and I have to, you know, he owns the screen whenever he's on it.
Yeah.
But Brie Larson just does not.
Yeah. And those are just valid criticisms. And hopefully when utilized by a proper directing team, we can finally get some good out of her, some good performance out of her that is worthy of the character and what they want to do with it. Because, you know, like I said, you know, we want to cheer on these characters, and we have been whenever we tote, you know, Battle Angel Alita, you know, we have been pushing this movement. You know, it's like, hey, we're standing with you. Whenever you try to make a movement, hey, we're there with you. We agree. We want the same thing. And it's just, you know, it's just with Battle Angel Alita, we kind of represent it a little bit better.
just a little bit. Slightly better.
Yeah, slightly a little bit better than what opponents have been championing as in their corner. And I would have to say, you know, hands down, Captain Marvel versus Alita wins.
Oh, every time.
Yeah. And in every single arena they try to push it into or that they have, you know, Alita would come out a clear winner because it it's representing everything that social media claims it wants to see. But by social media not championing this stuff, they just show that they're just, I hate to use the term shills.
Mm-hmm. But, no, they are. They are absolute shills.
Yeah, that they're just being shills. And you know, this is something where I have to say, you know, we got them. Ah, ha, ha. No, it's just at the end of the day, we want good movies. And that's why that's why we talk about this stuff and we're critical about it. You know, and we've been critical on Alita and Captain Marvel.
Yeah, no, there's flaws in Alita. There's flaws in everything, but it's still a quality movie.
Yeah, and we've pointed them out. And even with Captain Marvel, we haven't been hating on it completely.
No, and I mean, it's an enjoyable popcorn movie. If you go to it, you know, with a bucket of popcorn, I think you're not going to hate the time that you spent in the theater.
Yeah, and I think that we've presented a very fair argument, you know, for these films, and as far as what can be improved for future endeavors and stuff. I'll just wrap it up there. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I think that about does it. I, you know, my fingers are crossed for the future. I hope that the Marvel movies don't see the success of Captain Marvel and Black Panther as a template going forward and thinking they have to make it all about the politics. You know, Star Wars has gone down that road, and I think it has, you know, contributed to the toxic fandom of Star Wars. It has turned the fans against each other, and it made it an undesirable property in some ways. And I hope that Marvel doesn't do that. I don't think they will. I think they're smart enough to, you know, not fully commit to that. And especially now they've gotten, you know, two of, you know, their important representation movies out of the way, maybe they will see that as a job done and they can just go forward to telling good movies and good stories again.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us again where we can find you.
Jack Connor, ER on Amazon. I write epic fantasy, steampunk, and science fiction.
All right. And thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you later, kids.
Thank you very much for having me.